Welcome to Advanced TV Herstory, where hearty discussion of all things TV draws a nifty circle around the women who have made it all happen. In each installment, we endeavor to celebrate, educate, illustrate, or analyze, all in the hopes of reaching listeners with the message that TV and women are very much a part of our lives. And it's okie dokie, it's fine and dandy that we talk about it, at length, in detail, with delight. So find this podcast along the great ones at Libsyn, Google Music, iTunes, and Auto Radio. Engage with us on Twitter. Our handle is at TV Herstory. I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams. I hope you enjoy this installment. Hello, loyal listeners. It started off as a pleasant reminder of my childhood, doing a podcast installment on Dinah Shore, the classy lady with the best talk show of the 70s. She was cool and nice. She wore orange. She had something to do with golf. She laughed a lot, and she had a thing with Burt Reynolds. This is the perfect fodder for a podcast, right? Listeners, Dinah Shore, who was born in 1916 and passed in 1994, was more of a renegade feminist than her Tennessee accent would have us believe. Piecing together this look at her career and work as a woman pioneer in TV has required more context and research than is normally the case. But, in other words, it's been a lot of fun. So at Advanced TV Herstory, you know as well as I that we look for pioneers. We look for glass ceiling breakers, women who stood or stand with other women. The obvious ones wear shoulder pads the size of umbrellas. The less obvious ones appear in the form of demure, gracious Dinah Shore. Before I can tell you what and how she was a renegade, you need to learn a bit of context about Dinah, who was born with the name of Frances Rose Shore in Tennessee to Jewish parents. To transform herself to the woman who transitioned from radio stardom to TV, Shore changed her name from Fanny to Dinah, but that's not all. During her first appearances in the movies in the 40s, she had rhinoplasty, filled in a gap between her front teeth, and gradually transitioned her hair color from jet black to blonde. With a hospitable Tennessee accent, degree from Vanderbilt University, and lots of singing experience, and a marriage to a movie heartthrob George Montgomery, her life as the daughter of a Jewish shopkeeper, first in Winchester, Tennessee, and later Nashville, was not part of her media kit. Regular listeners of this podcast know that I try to confirm my work with sources. When I roll the credits at the end of each installment, it's with the idea that there's a lot of material out there, and I just curate and try to fit the pieces together to tell the story. Tracing the more controversial aspects of Dinah's career has been difficult, because what is printed or produced is largely vanity work. In a little bit, we'll get more into just how disappointing I found these sources, but suffice it to say it's sincere but fluffy stuff that's written in books published in the late 70s and 2-hour-long documentaries produced in 1999 and 2003. So we'll never know to what degree Dinah had to deal with anti-Semitism and the rumors that flew throughout her career that she was biracial and others that she had a child by an African-American. But if you Google this, you just even start a Google search, those searches fill in those words. I find that amazing. I'll say no more other than I would love to ask Dinah some of those questions about that time. She graduated from Vanderbilt University in 1938 with a degree in sociology. And since her days in high school and even growing up and then college, she had developed a solid stage presence. She had gotten out and she had acted in school shows and she had sung, not just in school productions, but in nightclubs. So it only made sense after graduation from Vanderbilt that she headed to New York. Her career in New York took off by virtue of a few good breaks in radio. These led to a recording contract and a tour throughout Europe with the USO. So if you look at wartime newsreels that show Dinah and other radio and movie stars entertaining the troops, you might not recognize her, since those were the years of her very dark hair, her heavy eyebrows, her natural nose. It was during World War II that she met actor George Montgomery, who she married in 1943 and divorced in 1962. But their star status put them on A-lists that ultimately formed a network that Dinah would later draw upon once she had the control of TV talk and variety show production. From radio, she jumped to film, mostly musicals, thus putting her career in direct competition with her husband's. Okay, this is where it starts to get interesting, both the facts themselves and how they've been reported over the years. And by the way, neither of them had too much of a film career. Okay, so I've said already that there's not a lot written or said about Dinah Shore, the progressive. That is sort of the premise of this podcast. But it is broached in the A&E biography segment that aired in 1999, or it certainly airs today on YouTube. It's narrated by Peter Graves and contains some clips from an important interview with Dinah and George's daughter, Melissa Montgomery. Let's set the stage.
But behind Dinah's genteel Southern manner was a strong-willed businesswoman who waged many battles when it came to issues close to her heart, such as segregation in the television industry. Rather than shy away from a potentially explosive situation which might revive old rumors about her racial background, Dinah fought network brass to perform with black entertainers.
There was a big battle over Nat King Cole because he was black. She really did the most that she could to break the barriers that the networks had set up.
Thanks to Dinah's fearless commitment to civil rights, black artists like Nat King Cole, Ella Fitzgerald, and Mahalia Jackson made numerous memorable appearances on her show.
Dinah grew up in a progressive home in Tennessee. Her mother had been an aspiring singer who set aside her dreams to raise a family. Dinah presumably never forgot this. Her TV career started in 1951 with a short 15-minute long shows, a lot of them. And in 1956, her credibility was such that she was given a full hour-length long show. It was sort of an experiment. Was America ready for this evolving singer? And was America ready for the guests, the incredibly talented singers who she wanted to have join her? Daughter Melissa Montgomery shared memories of this time in Dinah's career, recognizing that Dinah was really the only woman singer who was being given her own name show.
Ella Fitzgerald was my mother's idol. She had every recording that Ella Fitzgerald ever made. She would play the music and she would go on and on and on about Ella Fitzgerald, that Ella Fitzgerald was it. She was the woman who could really sing the song. She was the ultimate.
So it's really important to remember that America was a deeply segregated country in 1956 and 1957 when her show was getting launched. And while regional TV shows could cater to Southern or Northern interests, the Dinah Shore Chevy show, yes, she was the first pitch woman for an automaker. Her show was national. So maybe Dinah leveraged her popularity a bit and chose to be colorblind. That she chose to seek out performers who were popular around the country as they were on radio, where skin color wasn't seen. Again, Melissa Montgomery from the A&E biography.
Whatever their style of performance was, she was able to enhance that by her presence.
Pearl Bailey was one of a kind, her own invention. And what's funny is that for a good part of her career, she was considered risque.
Pearl Bailey was a great outspoken advocate of self-expression, as I experienced her.
She was just so endearing and so funny and so spontaneous. You never knew what was going to come out, but you knew you were going to have a good time watching her.
I still don't know whether we ought to sing Mac the Knife, though.
Well, why not, honey? It's a great song.
Well, I agree. I love the song, but my goodness, it's been done so much.
Just because people, you know, they play it over and over again, they don't know, they're trying to figure out what it means.
Yeah, I'm with them. I don't know what it means either.
Well, I tell you what, Donna, you sing it, and I'll explain it. You see, I belong to the teenage set.
Oh, you do. All right, you better talk plain. Ready?
Yep.
Oh, the shark has
what?
Pretty teeth, dear.
Uh-huh.
And he shows them.
How, Donna?
Pearly white.
That's my name, Pearly Me.
What's the jackknife?
Oh.
Has McKeith.
This man carries a weapon.
And he keeps it.
Where?
Out of sight.
Now, as I mentioned, there are only two tribute videos on YouTube. There are some episodes and some clips, a lot of clips on Dinah. It's all fun to watch. But the A&E documentary and the one produced by the Dinah Shore Living Trust, which is a tribute to the Dinah Shore show and uses clips to drive a biographical account, those are pretty much what's out there in a 45 to 50 minute long format. But it's in that full video that film and TV historian Leonard Maltin appears. This is the one that's called Moi, the Best of the Dinah Shore Show. Leonard Maltin appears, and yes, in 2003, he sort of whitewashes over what some might see as Dinah's greatest moment of character, when she defied the sponsors and the network in selecting African-American performers to appear on her show, alongside her other white star performers like Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby and Peggy Lee. Really, Leonard, do you expect us to believe you? This just seems like whitewash.
A show like this, having to come up with new guests and new ideas week after week and then year after year, season after season. Well, it sort of obliged the producers to look past the obvious and try to get all different kinds of people on the show.
For example, my mother was overjoyed to have Mahalia Jackson on the show. I think that in watching them perform, what I saw was that Mahalia struck a chord in my mother that was something that was a true part of her. And it was a joy for her to be able to sing the gospel music.
Going to lay down my sunshine down by the riverside.
From what I can piece together, maybe Dinah knew she had white privilege and she never blinked with NBC. Here's what else was going on at NBC for someone without nearly as much power as Dinah had at that time. The NBC Universal website history timeline reads as such. 1957. Nat King Cole is the first major black artist to have his own network series on NBC. And then the timeline citation explains this, quote, "Even with his enormous charm and stunning array of guests, Cole was unable to overcome resistance to a black headliner from some advertisers and affiliates. Unable to secure a national advertiser, NBC was forced to cancel the program in December of 1957." End quote. Jim Davidson has a website, www.classictvinfo.com, and it has a solid page on the Nat King Cole show, including descriptions of episodes that highlight, to be honest, the greatest African-American talent in the country at the time, and that's pretty significant. It's also the most detailed account of Madison Avenue's inability to sell advertisers on programming that featured non-white performers. Davidson quoted this statement from Cole on his site, quote, "Madison Avenue is the center of the advertising industry," Nat King Cole wrote, "and their big clients didn't want their products associated with Negroes. Ad Alley thinks it's still a white man's world," end quote. So imagine Cole singing with guests like his wife, Maria Cole, Eartha Kitt, and Count Basie with the full force of famed orchestra leader Nelson Riddle. This was a high-quality show, and it aired for a little more than a year, but suffered a low budget due to advertising challenges and time slot shifting, which is the death knell for a show that the network wants to get rid of. This is the context by which we have to apply Dinah's actions and convictions. The late 50s and early 60s, separate entrances for white performers, separate dressing rooms, whispers with the advertisers. Did Nat King Cole have physical contact on camera with one of his white guests? Did Dinah lean in too close to Pearl or Mahalia? So while there is no smoking gun to say that Dinah's show, which ran from 1956 to 1961, was threatened or harassed for similar advertising reasons, you can bet she never put out a statement calling out Madison Avenue. But she nonetheless tested the network by inviting some of the country's most prominent African-American performers to her show. Chevrolet's decision to drop sponsorship caused the show's cancellation. But what prompted Chevy's decision? That answer has eluded me. The Dinah Shore Chevy Show was a national favorite, earning Shore the 1958 Emmy for Best Continuing Performance by a Female in a Series by a Comedian, Singer, Hostess, Dancer, MC, Announcer, Narrator, Panelist, or any person who essentially plays herself. I think this brought in some of those black and white game shows that you see sometimes now on cable. That category morphed a bit the following year, in which Dinah won the 1959 Emmy for Best Performance by an Actress in Continuing Character in a Musical or Variety Series, because that's really what Dinah Shore's series evolved to be, variety. Dinah sort of sat out the latter part of the 60s. She divorced Montgomery and entered into a short-lived marriage with another guy. She was still a well-known name, so with the rapidly changing landscape of TV, music, and American society, I give her credit for just laying low. In 1970, Dinah returned to NBC as the host of a 30-minute variety morning talk show. She would appear on TV for a full decade in some version of this format, earning an Emmy in 1973 for Outstanding Program Achievement in Daytime for Dinah's Place. Dinah's Place. That was the name of the show, which if you were an 8-year-old watching while you're homesick from school, it was just cool to think that a woman older than your mom had a place where people like Frank Sinatra just dropped by for coffee and a chat. Dinah's Place was nominated or won every year it was on from 1974 to 1981 in the category of Best Host or Hostess in a Talk, Service, or Variety Series. By the time Dinah signed off from her regular TV gig, she had some serious Emmy hardware on her mantle at her place. Yep, by the mid-1970s, when Dinah was a staple of daytime TV, she was a little bit Oprah and a little bit Martha Stewart, and she became romantically linked with the emerging heartthrob Burt Reynolds. So yes, there was a 20-year difference between the two, call it a May-October relationship, which wouldn't have been given a second thought if the May was, say, a 21-year-old Mia Farrow with a 51-year-old December named Frank Sinatra, and that was all going on at the time. But listen closely to this clip, which I've included, not because you need to know more about Dinah and Burt, everybody kind of knows about that, but rather the careful words Burt uses, this is again in, you know, kind of right around 2000, to describe his relationship with and his feelings for Dinah.
It was extraordinary. I mean, I've never had that feeling before or since, where you just felt like you knew somebody for, you know, eons, and there was such warmth.
He's not exactly effusive. Did he sell you? Burt could have been talking about a dear neighbor or a mentor. And in watching these two specials, I was also struck by subtle language employed by Pat Boone, the teen heartthrob crooner, who later became a politically conservative standard bearer. Pat is gracious in his kind words about Dinah, very nice words that could have come from an obituary or a Wikipedia page. He makes it hard, though, to believe that Dinah was one of his favorite people. Again, there's not a lot of emotion there. But then again, he never was a very good actor. And to watch the video, much of the time he's either leaned away from the camera or sits there with his arms folded. So the following clip is Pat's comment about Dinah's legacy, and notice how he puts such tremendous qualification on it, and it's followed by her daughters. At least one of them was sincere.
Dinah's place in the pantheon of musical greats, you know, and American pop music is secure, and of course a trailblazer, a pioneer, a gentle, a womanly, a ladylike pioneer, but nonetheless a pioneer.
I'd love to have her remembered as a person, a woman who cut a path for other women, who set an example in so many different areas of her life that women of every generation can look to with admiration. I'm proud of her.
Okay, we won't get in any further to what the deal is that Pat Boone didn't like Dinah Shore, but you can probably guess a few things. So Dinah Shore passed away in February 1994 of ovarian cancer. She never made her diagnosis public. Later that year, she was inducted posthumously into the LPGA Hall of Fame as the first non-professional golfer. At the time, the hall was pretty empty. Dinah was only the 13th entry. Again, more context that helps you understand why she was righteous in her feminism. Back in 1972, just as Title IX and the Equal Rights Amendment, let's give a tip of the hat to the Nixon administration for those two, were becoming reality, Dinah founded a women's golf tournament, which was LPGA sanctioned, that has been held annually at the Mission Hills Country Club in Rancho Mirage, California. In 1983, it became a major tournament, which is kind of a major accomplishment in and of itself. Since 2000, corporate naming rights usurped Dinah's fingerprint. It's technically not called the Dinah Shore Tournament anymore. But during the explosion of women's golf and representation on TV, the Dinah Shore Tournament was a TV favorite and resulted in an increase in prize money for golfers, an increase in presence and knowledge of the sport. That increase really only meant that the prize money, the difference between the men's and the women's prizes, was reduced from 3-1, $3 to every $1, to more like 2.5-1. But still, it was measurable, visible progress. Dinah Shore was to golf what Billie Jean King was to tennis, making those two sports, otherwise a staple of the country club, to girls and women, and it gave them the confidence to get out and learn and play and be active. And that was, ultimately, one of the pushes that got Title IX to something of a success for girls in the 70s. But here's how Dinah describes the whole thing in a clip embedded in the A&E biography episode found on YouTube.
I've been told by dozens of young players starting out that this is the one they really want to win. I'm thrilled, and I'm grateful. It wasn't always that way. Back in 1972, we didn't dare to dream beyond a couple of years.
That Southern accent, that grace, that cool, it makes you want to take up golf, right? But there's always a reminder of how far we've slipped. Here's how two men on the NBC Golf Channel described Dinah's impact on the game of women's golf. Now, mind you, how hard would it have been, how many phone calls would it have taken to get a woman to be interviewed for these 2 minutes to discuss Dinah Shore on the celebration of what would have been her 100th birthday, 2016. Geesh.
It's great to be with you. Dinah Shore, a name that a lot of us remember watching television. She was a singer, a big-time personality. What was her impact to golf?
Well, she was a huge star at that time. I remember her TV show. It was an enormously popular TV show. That was a crucial turning point for the LPGA. She was their Bing Crosby, their Bob Hope, their Jackie Gleason. She was the star who brought other stars into the tent for the Pro-Am, brought more media attention to it, and she remained just a loyal supporter of the tour right to the end.
Her statue is still there at Mission Hills. I know you got to meet her. What was she like?
The word would be passionate, enthusiastic, upbeat, you know, that. And that she always brought that energy to the event. And you could tell, you could see, even now when the players finish and they give the high five to the Dinah statue going around there, it's almost like they're still channeling that energy.
The players appreciate her still. You think they know who she is and what she did?
They've done a good job at that tournament at continuing that communication going along and making sure that the newer generation of players know what she contributed to the LPGA.
Maybe we can agree that very few women celebrities' legacies grew or expanded after their deaths. And while you're thinking hard about that statement, let me rid you of the idea that merchandising the images of Marilyn Monroe or Audrey Hepburn count, because they don't. Legacies are not built on a few inspirational quotes or photos imprinted on drink coasters. However, for Dinah Shore, it's all different. Since 1991, Dinah Shore, or simply The Dinah, has become the largest girl party musical festival in the world. I spoke to The Dinah's founder and CEO, Mariah Hansen, about the event, which is held in 2017 from March 29th to April 2nd. We talked about its growth and its relationship, if any, with Dinah Shore. So Hanson has grown The Weeknd, which is in effect an effort to create a lesbian world within the city of Palm Springs, and she initially identified it to overlap with the golf tournament that bore Dinah Shore's name, and it's become the largest lesbian event in the world, attracting visitors worldwide. It's ranked in the top 10 annual events held in Palm Springs, which is pretty heady competition or a pretty influential list. And it spans 5 days of intense business for the hospitality sector. And Palm Springs is a hospitality capital. Hanson and the Dinah have been recognized by the Regents of the University of California and the State Assembly. The Dinah is here to stay. But learn more about the Dinah by Googling them. Not just as Hanson shared to learn about the event from the Dinah's event organizers, but also to track The Weeknd's evolution through the worldwide news items that have been posted online. So you're thinking to yourself, so is the Dinah sanctioned by the family? Did Mariah Hanson have to pay naming rights? Do the women who attend the event, who were not even teenagers when Dinah Shore passed away, do they have any idea what a total feminist Dinah Shore was? Those are great questions, and here are the answers. Hanson says that the event's first couple years, while Dinah was still alive, she knew about the weekend retreat. At no time then or since has there been any claim or request from Dinah Shore's family or estate about anything. No formal agreement at all. Hanson's never polled her attendees about their knowledge of Dinah Shore, which she says now the average attendee is in the range of the early 30s, kind of 32 to 35-ish. So in my head, I see Dinah, and maybe me, sitting out on her Palm Springs terrace, sorting out her finest moments in show business. And if I had been sitting there, of course I would have had to have been basically kind of a teenager or young adult, I would have said, Dinah, what mattered more? All those Emmys or staring down NBC in the late 50s on behalf of Pearl and Mahalia and Nat? And then I'd ask, so that whole Burt Reynolds thing, was that just a media ploy to fend off other rumors? And if it was, that's okay. Good for you. And why is it that Pat Boone looked like he'd rather talk about how well his dentist performs root canal than say too many sincere, nice things about you? Dinah. And then I'd look at her and she'd get a glimmer in her eye, knowing that women were gathering in her name, in her town, to feel better about themselves during a weekend of community. But I'll never get a chance to ask those questions, so in the end, we'll never know. My sources for this segment on Dinah Shore come from all the usual places. On YouTube, you'll readily find the 1999 A&E biography episode, and you will also find about a 50-minute video that once appeared on TV called Moi, The Best of the Dinah Shore Show, and it was produced in 2003, in part by the Dinah Shore Living Trust. Now, the books that are out there are a little, well, peaked. I read Bruce Cassaday's 1979 Dinah, a biography, and Michael Druxman's Miss Dinah Shore, a biography. Wow, talk about original titles. Druxman's book was largely written in the mid-1970s. It was only published recently, but it reads like it was written then because both books were written in the middle of a varied career that attracted little negative publicity. And neither book offers much insight into this woman who we now realize blazed trails and experienced the best and the worst of the entertainment industry. Information about Dinah's legacy with the LPGA can be found at their website, which mainly now has boiled down to some information about scholarships that bear her name. Audio from the 100th anniversary of Dinah's birth and her impact on the game of women's golf is found at NBC Sports The Golf Channel site. It's just too bad they didn't ask a woman to recount the significance of Dinah and her legacy. NBC Universal's website has a fairly high level of timeline. It's great, but it's quite sanitized. While Jim Davidson's website, www.classictvinfo.com, that's all one word, proved helpful in piecing together what little is available about TV decision-making before the civil rights era. And I know that there is some scholarly work floating around out there as well. Perhaps that will be the topic of another Advanced TV Herstory podcast segment sometime. Many thanks to Mariah Hansen, founder of The Dyna, for being available for the phone call that cleared up some really important questions and that, in a sense, put a capstone on Dinah Shore's legacy as a feminist. And as always, this podcast sounds good due to the work of the talented David Brown. Subscribe to this podcast via our hosting site, Libsyn, or iTunes. You can also find it on Auto Radio. If you've got something to share about Dinah Shore, feminism, or anything else TV and women related, drop a line to advancedtvherstory@gmail.com. If you've got an interest, we'd love to bring it forward. Follow the podcast on Twitter. Our handle is @TVHerstory. And lastly, find this script and those from past installments at my website, www.cynthiabemisabrams.com. Please share or recommend Advanced TV Herstory to others. That's how the word spreads. It's an earful of learning for women and men of all ages. And the segments are clean enough that you can even recommend it to your grandma. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams.